They got caught, not by a whistleblower, not by a leak, not by some brave insider who risked their career to hand a journalist a folder of documents that were never supposed to see daylight. They got caught by their own data, by the export figures that the government publishes because it is legally required to publish them, by the numbers that have been sitting in plain sight in the trade statistics and the resource revenue reports and the tax office data for years, available to anyone with the patience to read them and the willingness to follow where they lead. $68 billion. That is the value of the oil and gas that left Australian shores last year. $68 billion worth of Australian resources, pulled from Australian ground, loaded onto tankers at Australian ports, and shipped to customers in Asia and beyond. And the tax that was collected on that $68 billion, the revenue that flowed back to the Australian public that owns those resources by birthright, was so negligible, so structurally engineered towards zero by a tax regime that was designed to collect almost nothing and has performed exactly as designed, that the gap between what was taken and what was returned to the people it was taken from is not a rounding error. It is a policy choice, a deliberate, sustained, documented policy choice that has been made and remade by successive governments across decades. And the consequences of that choice are now sitting in the household budgets of ordinary Australians in the form of fuel bills and electricity prices and interest rates and a cost of living crisis that the same governments that made the choice are now expressing concern about. The concern would be more convincing if they had not caused it. I want to start with the tax, because the tax is where the story begins and where it keeps returning no matter how many other threads you pull. Australia has a mechanism called the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax. It was designed in theory to capture a share of the profits from offshore oil and gas production for the Australian public. It was designed to ensure that the companies extracting Australian resources paid a meaningful contribution to the country whose geological luck they were monetizing. It sounds reasonable. It sounds like exactly the kind of mechanism that a competent government would put in place to ensure that a finite natural resource generates lasting public benefit, rather than being extracted and exported and converted entirely into private profit with nothing left behind except the holes in the ground. The reality of what the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax actually collects bears almost no relationship to what it was designed to collect. The mechanism that was supposed to capture resource rents has been structured in a way that allows the companies subject to it to offset their tax liability against such a comprehensive and generously defined list of costs and deductions and historical expenditures that several of the largest gas exporters in the country, companies generating billions of dollars of revenue from Australian resources, have paid zero in resource tax for years. Not a reduced amount. Not a discounted rate. Zero. And this is not a secret hidden in classified government documents. It is in the tax office data. It is in the parliamentary inquiry transcripts. It has been reported and documented and raised in Senate estimates hearings and responded to with language about the complexity of the regime and the importance of investment certainty and the need for careful consideration of any changes that might affect the confidence of the sector. Investment certainty. That is the phrase. That is the shield that has been held up every time someone with the numbers in front of them has asked why the Australian public is collecting almost nothing from the extraction of its own resources. Investment certainty. The companies need to be confident that the rules will not change. They need to know that the arrangements they negotiated when they made their investment decisions will be honored. They need stability. And so the stability has been provided. Decades of stability. Stability that has delivered $68 billion of Australian resources to global markets in a single year, while the Australians, who own those resources, were making decisions about whether to turn the heating on. Now look at Norway. I keep coming back to Norway because Norway is not a theoretical alternative. It is not a policy experiment that has never been tried at scale. It is a real country with a real economy that made a real decision about how to manage its natural resources and produced a real outcome that is now so large and so consequential that it has become the benchmark against which every other resource-rich nation's policy choices are measured. Norway found oil in 1969. It was a small country, a cold country, a country with no particular reason to believe it would become one of the wealthiest nations on Earth per capita within two generations. It could have done what Australia did. It could have handed the extraction rights to multinationals, collected a modest royalty, called it economic development, and spent the revenue as it arrived on whatever the political priorities of the moment happened to be. Instead, Norway decided that the oil belonged to the Norwegian people. Not metaphorically, not rhetorically. Structurally and legally, and with a taxation regime that ensured the statement was true in practice and not just in principle, the Norwegian state takes a share of oil company profits that makes Australian resource taxation look like an oversight. It channels that revenue into a sovereign wealth fund that now holds over $1.7 trillion. $1.7 trillion. invested globally, generating returns, paying for public services, buffering the Norwegian economy against every external shock that has arrived in the 50 years since the fund was established. Norway has more money saved per person in its sovereign wealth fund than Australia has in its entire future fund. And Australia is sitting on resources that make the North Sea look modest. The question of where the Australian money went is not a complicated one. It did not go into a sovereign wealth fund. It did not go into energy infrastructure. It did not go into fuel reserves. It did not go into the domestic refining capacity that would make Australia less dependent on imported fuel. It went to the shareholders of the companies that extracted it. It went to the executives who structured the deals. It went through the revolving door that connects the energy sector to the government offices that regulate it and the consultancies that advise both. And now it is gone. It is not recoverable. The resources that generated it are depleted or committed. The window that existed to build the Norwegian outcome, to take the geological lottery ticket that Australian geography provided and convert it into generational financial security for the Australian public, that window has been closing for decades. And the people who were supposed to be protecting it were leaving it open for someone else to walk through. Now let me talk about what this means for energy security. Because the revenue failure is not just a financial problem. It is a physical problem. It is a problem that shows up not in a spreadsheet, but at a fuel pump. Australia has four operational refineries, four refineries to supply the fuel needs of a continent-sized country of 26 million people who are almost entirely dependent on road transport for the movement of goods and people across distances that make European logistics look trivial. Four refineries producing a fraction of domestic demand. The rest comes from imports, from Singapore, from South Korea, from supply chains that stretch thousands of kilometers across open ocean and depend on the continuous, uninterrupted function of global trade systems that have demonstrated repeatedly in the past 5 years that they are neither continuous nor uninterrupted. The refineries that are gone were not closed because they were unnecessary. They were closed because imported refined fuel was cheaper in the short term, and the economic logic of the moment made domestic refining capacity look like an inefficiency rather than a strategic asset. This is the specific kind of thinking that produces resilient systems in calm weather and catastrophic failures and storms. When everything is working, domestic refining capacity looks redundant. When the supply chain breaks, it looks like the most important infrastructure the country owns. Australia has been making the calm weather calculation for 30 years, and is now discovering that the storm does not announce itself far enough in advance for the calculation to be revised in time to matter. The reserve situation makes the refining situation worse. The International Energy Agency recommends that member countries hold 90 days of fuel reserves, the buffer that allows a country to absorb a supply disruption without immediately transmitting that disruption into its domestic economy as fuel shortages and price spikes and the cascade of cost increases that flow from fuel prices, through freight costs, through food prices, through every sector of the economy that depends on energy inputs, which is every sector of the economy. 90 days. Australia holds less than 30 in most fuel categories, in some categories, in some regions, considerably less. The government's own reports acknowledge this. The gap between the recommended standard and the actual reserve level has been documented through inquiry after inquiry and recommendation after recommendation. And the reserve sits where it sits, not because building it was impossible, because building it would have cost money that was available from the resource revenue that was not captured because the tax regime was structured to not capture it. This is the circularity of the failure. The revenue that was not taken from the gas exporters was the revenue that could have funded the reserves that would have protected the country from the supply vulnerability that the absence of revenue left it exposed to. Every part of the failure connects to every other part. The tax structure produces the revenue gap. The revenue gap produces the underinvestment. The underinvestment produces the vulnerability. The vulnerability produces the supply disruptions. The supply disruptions produce the price increases. The price increases produce the cost of living crisis, and the cost of living crisis produces the political pressure that the government responds to with fuel excise cuts that reduce the revenue available for the investment that would address the vulnerability. Round and round, each rotation making the underlying structural problem slightly worse, while the political response to each crisis is calibrated to manage the immediate headline rather than the long-term condition. The distinction between external and internal pressure is the most important thing to understand about Australia's energy situation right now. Because the political framing of every fuel supply problem that has emerged in the past several years has reached reflexively for the external explanation. Global factors, the war in Ukraine, supply chain disruptions, the Strait of Hormuz, these things are real. They produce real pressure on global energy markets. And that pressure is transmitted to Australian consumers through import prices and shipping costs and the interconnected nature of global commodity markets. Nobody is denying that external shocks matter. But external shocks hit every country. They hit Norway, they hit Qatar, they hit Canada, they hit every resource-rich nation that has navigated the same global energy market that Australia navigates, and the countries that built sovereign wealth funds and maintained strategic reserves and preserved domestic refining capacity and structured their resource taxation to actually capture public value from public resources absorb those shocks differently. Not painlessly, not without cost. But with the buffers and the financial depth and the structural resilience that means a global supply disruption becomes an uncomfortable period of elevated prices rather than a crisis that requires an emergency plan and produces bags over fuel pump nozzles in suburban Australian towns. The emergency plan that gets activated when the bowsers run dry is not evidence of a government responding effectively to an unpredictable crisis. It is evidence of a system that was designed without the redundancy to handle predictable disruption and is now reaching for emergency measures, because the non-emergency measures were never built. Cutting the fuel excise is real relief, and it should not be dismissed. For the household that is already at the limit of what its budget can absorb, a reduction in the price at the pump matters. But it matters the way that a painkiller matters to someone who needs surgery. It addresses the symptom. It does not touch the condition. And the condition, the structural dependence on imported fuel, the inadequate reserves, the insufficient resource taxation, the absence of the sovereign wealth fund that Norway built from a geological starting point, less advantageous than Australia's, that condition is not improved by an excise cut. It is deferred. It is managed into the next news cycle, and the one after that until the next disruption arrives, and the emergency plan gets activated again, and the commentary expresses shock that this keeps happening in a country this rich. Australia is not a poor country that cannot afford to do this better. Australia is a rich country that has been making choices that make it poorer. The resources were real. The revenue was available. The models existed. Norway proved that the model works. The decision not to implement it was not inevitable. It was not forced by geology or geography or the structure of global energy markets. It was a policy choice, made in rooms with people who understood the alternative, made in favor of the companies whose lobbyists were in the room and against the households whose representatives were supposed to be in the room on their behalf. The $68 billion number is not an abstraction. It is the price of the sovereign wealth fund that does not exist. It is the price of the reserves that were not built. It is the price of the refineries that were not maintained. It is the price of the buffer that would have meant that when the global supply chain next hiccuped, Australia would have absorbed the shock rather than transmitted it directly into the household budgets of the people who are now being told that global factors outside anyone's control are responsible for what they are paying at the pump. The data caught them. The numbers are public. The comparison with Norway is not complicated. The gap between what was possible and what was chosen is not ambiguous, and the emergency plan that has now been activated is the clearest possible evidence that the choice was wrong. Not in retrospect, not with the benefit of hindsight, wrong at the time it was made by people who had access to the same numbers that are now sitting in the public record proving it.